It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Then-candidate Donald Trump surprised many with his capturing of Pennsylvania in November 2016 on his way to winning the presidency. But since then, Democrats have scored several wins in the Commonwealth in congressional, gubernatorial, and legislative races. Yesterday at this time, we spoke with the chair of the state Democratic Party. Today, we are joined by the chairman of the Pennsylvania Republican Party, Val DiGiorgio. Val, welcome to the Confluence.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start with Donald Trump won Pennsylvania by about 45,000 votes, despite a huge margin for Hillary Clinton in southeastern Pennsylvania and in Allegheny County. So why did Donald Trump become the first Republican in 28 years to capture Pennsylvania?
Well, he did it in what had been an unconventional way for Republicans to win the state, which is to really rack up really good, not just turnout in the center part of the state, in the western part of the state, as high as 70 to 80% returns, but also winning some Democrat areas like Luzerne County, traditionally Democrat areas like Cambria County. And he got a lot of union vote, especially from the trade unions and steel workers, unions like that, and was able to speak out in a way to workers who felt that they had lost ground for the last 20 years that no Republican or even Democrat had been able to do in Pennsylvania.
Right. You mentioned some geographic areas as well as demographics. It used to be, it seems to me, that for Republicans to win statewide contests, don't lose overwhelmingly in the Philly area and surrounding counties and hold down the Democratic margin in Allegheny County and chip away at southwestern Pennsylvania, then win big, as you said, in central and northern PA. Is that still the formula, or has the landscape in Pennsylvania changed?
Well, I think it depends on the candidate. You look at Pat Toomey's victory in 2016, and that's how he won, the way you just said, which is actually he did well in the Philly suburbs. For instance, Chester County, where he won that county by 6,000 votes. But Donald Trump lost that county by 23,000 votes. That's a huge swing. So Donald Trump had to rack up even bigger numbers. And like I said, win in those traditionally Democrat strongholds in northeastern Pennsylvania and parts of southwestern Pennsylvania. So there's two different roadmaps on how you win Pennsylvania. And, we'll see what's in play for 2020.
Right.
Donald Trump's plan is, yeah.
After the 2016 election, there were 13 Republicans and 5 Democrats in the Pennsylvania congressional delegation. After 2018, the midterm election, it was split evenly 9-9. In your mind, what happened?
Well, I mean, first of all, you had just the normal midterm election. The party out of power has the intensity. You know, we saw that all through the Obama years where his party lost 1,000 seats. And the state house and state legislature seats and the House and Senate. So that's a normal occurrence, the midterm election. But what happened in Pennsylvania was that after we had lost the 2015 Supreme Court race and lost 3 seats that were up that year, we had what amounted to a very partisan Supreme Court that decided that they could take power from the legislature that's given to them under the state and federal constitution, the legislature to draw lines, congressional lines, which is a piece of legislation, and say that since it didn't match the registration number, since there were so many more Republicans than Democrats in the congressional delegation, that it was unfair, and because it was unfair, it was unconstitutional, and they had the right to redraw lines. Mm-hmm. We thought that was a power grab. We still think that. Managed to steal as many as 4 seats because of that. So the combination of the midterm elections, some retirements, we had 5 retirements among the Republican delegation, and the Supreme Court's unconstitutional power grab resulted in us losing some seats last year.
All right. So you're saying the retirements and the new map that was drawn and ordered by the state Supreme Court. But what about in races, maybe the Democratic candidates, their message resonated better than the Republican candidates? Was that not a factor, or were there any other factors, you think, in certain races?
I think the Republican Party needs to have a better message on health care. And we have plans on health care, on how to lower premiums and make coverage more affordable and more widespread. But we just don't have a, it's not coming from the leadership level. And We need to have a message on healthcare to appeal, especially to suburban voters. And in some of those races last year, Mike Kelly's race, which we won, and Scott Perry's race, which we won, we were not able to make that case. And as a result, the Democrats were able to lie about the record of those folks running for Congress, saying they did not support, for instance, coverage for pre-existing conditions. That was an out-and-out lie.
Well, how so? I mean, you're saying they lied. How so?
Because these candidates did support coverage for pre-existing conditions. It's a lie. So, but shame on us for not having a message. And if we don't have a message on healthcare, your opponents are then able to come out and muddy the water and sometimes even out-and-out lie. Now, we corrected the record and ultimately won those seats, but, you know, we had to pivot in September on that message.
Well, was that the candidate's fault for not getting out in front and truly expressing what they thought about healthcare coverage or what it was, whatever it was?
No, it wasn't the candidate's fault. They had voted for legislation which covered pre-existing conditions before.
Okay.
So you tell a lie, it's the fault of the person who tells the lie.
Were there any Democratic victories that actually surprised you among the congressional races? Then you thought, hold it, I'm shocked by that one.
No, none of them really shocked me. There were races I thought I thought Keith Rothfuss might do better. That race was disappointing because Keith's a good man and I think represents that district a little more closely than Connor Lamb does. Connor Lamb's going to have to separate himself from the extremists in his caucus, and we'll see if he's able to do that. People like AOC and Ilhan Omar. So that race was disappointing, and I thought that would be a little closer. But none of the other races, really, I would say, were shockers. Mm-hmm.
Do you think local voters, and by that I mean Pennsylvania voters in a certain region, in a certain congressional district, even pay attention to what other Democrats there are in the U.S. House from other states, I mean, that you alluded to?
Typically, they do when it comes to leadership. I mean, Nancy Pelosi has been, for Republicans, very much a unifying force. People like Maxine Waters, who say extreme things, and certainly AOC, and now this Ilhan Omar, who's really said some inflammatory things about the state of Israel, really gets to show what the extreme left of the Democrat Party is really about. And voters, especially that Republican base, do tend to pay attention to that, and it does drive them out to vote.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Our guest is the chair of the Pennsylvania Republican Party, Val DiGiorgio. In our remaining few minutes, I want to ask you, as you look ahead to 2020, where do you feel you've made the most inroads demographically and geographically?
Well, like I said, we're continuing to make inroads into traditionally Democratic strongholds, places like southwestern Pennsylvania below Pittsburgh. We're work in places like Westmoreland, Washington County, where we have some very important county commissioner races. We expect to win those and take the majorities there for the first time in many, many years. And in northeastern Pennsylvania. And it's typically union workers, especially with the trades. We're doing very, very well with trade union workers with our support for the natural gas industry and all the jobs that means. Our support for the steel industry, and we're seeing steel jobs come back to Pennsylvania, thanks in part to the good work that President Trump is doing. So that's where we're making our major inroads. But I'm also looking to the cities. I think the President of the United States can say I've done more in the last 3 years for African Americans and Latinos than Barack Obama did in 8. Criminal justice reform, lowest unemployment ever in those communities, opportunity zones, support for charter schools. I really am imploring the president to take that message into our cities.
Since you brought up the president, Mr. Trump did very well with labor unions in 2016, including mm-hmm. here in Pennsylvania. That's a group that traditionally has leaned left and one that Democratic candidates such as Joe Biden are already courting. So what do you need to do? What does Mr. Trump need to do to shore up that support that he won in 16 so it's still there in 20?
Well, it's going to be there in 20, notwithstanding whatever the party bosses decide that they're told from their international down in Washington, D.C. what to do. We saw that in 2016. The economy needs to stay strong. He needs to make sure he keeps talking about the importance of creating jobs, creating wealth. And creating opportunity. I talk to labor union leaders, and they tell me they have more positions than they had people to work for them. They can't find people to fill jobs. And these aren't low-paying jobs. These are jobs that start at $40,000 and $45,000 a year and go up from there once you get training. Jobs for like welding and electric workers unions and people who lay pipe in Pennsylvania. So we just need to keep the word out of what Donald Trump has done to get this economy going. He'll get those voters, even if some of the party bosses have to take their marching orders from somewhere else.
We have about a minute left or so. Mr. Trump has always been controversial. Some love him, some don't. How do you think the president himself is playing here in Pennsylvania?
Well, again, I think it depends on where you are. I mean, in the mid-state, southwestern Pennsylvania, those areas I talked about, they love him. We saw that in 2016. The most common refrain I heard from county chairs, Republican Party chairs across the state is, we've never seen anything like this, the intensity and enthusiasm. That will remain. Suburbs are a tougher place these days for Republican Party across the country. And I think having a message on healthcare and the environment, education, will be important to get the suburbs back somewhere to where they were in the past.
In a couple of sentences, just a couple of sentences, 12 months from now, you should have a pretty good idea of which Democrat will take on President Trump, whoever that candidate is. How much does it matter in your approach who that candidate is versus in helping Donald Trump become the first Republican to win Pennsylvania twice in a row since Ronald Reagan?
Yeah, look, if they run an extremist, a very left-winger, somebody who's for socialism and $94 trillion in new taxes under the New Green Deal, et cetera, then it's going to be very easy for the president. If they could get a moderate, and I don't think you can get one through a Democrat primary, that'll make it a little trickier. But no matter who wins, we feel good about the president's record.
Val DiGiorgio is the chairperson of the Pennsylvania Republican Party. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And if you missed our interview with Democratic Chairperson Nancy Patton Mills, you can catch that at our website, wesa.fm/confluence, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
A good stage name can mean the difference between worldwide success and utter disinterest for a musician. Would the world have embraced Reginald Dwight the way it embraced his successor? I guess we'll never know. On this day in 1968, a young Reginald Dwight was on an airplane headed home after his final gig with his band, Bluesology. You see, Mr. Dwight was about to embark on a journey of his own, dreaming of stardom, his piano front and center in his new solo band. He asked his bandmate, horn player Elton Dean, and their lead singer, Long John Baldry, if he could combine their names to make a new one. They agreed, and Elton John was born. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Hundreds of gun rights supporters crowded into the state capitol Monday for the annual Second Amendment rally. Pennsylvania's gun laws have not been changed significantly in more than a decade. But WESA's Katie Meyer reports the speakers, demonstrators, and lawmakers say they're worried such efforts are picking up steam.
The morning of the rally, state capitol police are much busier than usual. Most days, if a person with a concealed carry permit wants to go into the Capitol building, they can drop off their gun in a side room by the back entrance. Officer Richard Scher says getting one in a day is generally considered a lot. But today, police anticipated so many guns, they opened a separate processing room. Can you estimate how many people you've gotten in here today?
What do we got up there? We're in the 50s range.
Scher estimates about 100 concealed weapons will be checked by the day's end. The people who carry those guns come from all around the state, and they have a range of reasons for taking off work on a Monday to demonstrate in Harrisburg. Take Anthony Bruno, a tall guy in a come-and-take-it T-shirt who's standing by the outdoor fountain because he didn't want to check his gun to go inside.
You know, we're not going to just sit back and let our rights be chipped away at by something that's just a feel-good measure.
Sheva Dewar, who did check her 9mm handgun, comes at it from a different angle. The Navy veteran and transgender woman says she's probably farther left than most here, but she's adamant about guns.
As long as they're beating and killing transgenders for using the inappropriate bathroom or something, I need the gun. I can't outrun them, and I can't outfight a group.
Firearms laws vary widely by state. In the last decade and a half, Pennsylvania's haven't changed much. For instance, background checks are required for private sales of handguns, but not long guns. Firearms don't have to be registered with the state. Open carry is allowed. Last session, groups fighting to end gun violence got a rare win, with a measure that requires convicted domestic abusers to give up their weapons more quickly and stops letting friends and family keep custody of them.
That is heinous.
At the rally, that bill was the subject of derision, as was one that's making progress this year, a so-called extreme risk protection bill to let police and family petition a judge to temporarily restrict a person's ability to possess firearms, as long as they can prove the person is a danger to themselves or others. Eric Pratt is the executive director for Gun Owners of America.
No trial by jury, no having your attorney present, no facing your accuser, just boom, a judge takes the word of somebody who may have a vendetta against you, and you lose your guns.
Montgomery County Representative Todd Stevens is sponsoring the extreme risk bill. He's a Republican, though Pratt and the other ralliers called him a rhino, Republican in name only. He says the gun rights crowd is misinterpreting the legislation.
They don't understand the current state of the law. Today in Pennsylvania, you can be 302'd, which means you're taken away from your home, your family, your job for up to 5 days, and then you lose your gun rights for life, and you have no due process whatsoever.
Stevens is pitching his bill as an alternative. He notes he's been able to win over a number of fellow Republicans, but he acknowledges some will never get on board. Those adamant opponents were out in force.
Baker, Bartolotta, Brewster, Brooks, Hutchinson. I know I saw Scott behind me, Senator Scott Martin. You're going to hear from Senator Kristen Phillips Hill.
One of them is Representative Daryl Metcalf. The Butler County Republican frequently finds himself in the news for his skepticism of mainstream climate science and opposition to an LGBTQ non-discrimination bill, among other things. But gun rights are one of his biggest pet issues. He founded the annual Second Amendment rally in 2006. He says attention has ebbed and flowed since then, generally picking up steam when a major shooting happens. His role, he says, is to stand firm.
I think it's going to be a hard position for any of our leaders to move legislation that will have more gun control as part of it. There's going to be more consequences brought to bear this year by myself and others if they try to.
Shira Goodman, director for the gun control group Ceasefire PA, says she's not trying to antagonize Second Amendment supporters. She's trying to be pragmatic.
We continue to want to do things that promote safety, that will save lives, that will reduce gun violence.
Lately, Goodman's main focus has been Representative Stevens' extreme risk bill. She thinks it has a shot at passing, but adds, as always when it comes to guns in Pennsylvania, it will be an uphill battle. Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last week, President Trump met with Democratic leaders and came to sort of an agreement to invest $2 trillion in infrastructure. Different ideas on how to pay for it, well, they still have to be bridged. The chair of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee came to Pittsburgh yesterday. WESA's transportation and development reporter Margaret J. Krause met up with Congressman Peter DeFazio. Good morning, Margaret.
Good morning.
So, was this a fact-finding, a data-gathering trip? What was it?
The chairman has been traveling across the country looking at infrastructure. So he mentioned several times he was under the Hudson River last week looking at the tunnels there and what would happen if something failed. He was learning about our locks and dams, our transit, the airport, the bus rapid transit right. proposal. Yeah. So it was to find out what is the situation and then to hear ideas on what could be funded.
Any other members of his committee doing similar trips or is it all on him?
No, I can't speak to. Right. I don't know if other commission members are also traveling around.
All right. So who accompanied him here on his local trip? What local officials?
Sure. Well, Congressman Mike Doyle, as well as Connor Lamb. And then Allegheny County Executive Roots Fitzgerald and Mayor Bill Peduto, as well as the Director of the Department of Mobility and Infrastructure, Karina Ricks, and some PWSA folks.
What did DeFazio visit?
Oh, well, I have the full rundown.
Oh, okay.
They went to the airport because that's where a new terminal will be built. They went to Montgomery Lock and Dam, which is in Beaver County, which is on the point of a, quote, catastrophic failure. They visited one of the landslide sites in the West End, the Greenleaf Slide. They went to see the CAP project, which will be a park over 579 at the old arena site. They drove the BRT route. They went to the East Liberty Transit Center. And then they came down Washington Boulevard in Pittsburgh to look at the Larimer Avenue Bridge, and then to go to a PWSA pumping station.
Did the local leaders, you mentioned Congressman Doyle and Lamb and the mayor and the county exec, did they sort of give their priority list to the congressman?
The press was not on any of the tour, right. But yes, they said, you know, we have lots of big problems that we need to fix in this region, and it's holding us back. It's putting us at a competitive disadvantage is what the county executive said.
And it all comes down to how do you pay for it? At the White House meeting, it was suggested to roll back the tax cut. That idea was practically struck down immediately.
Exactly. Senator Mitch McConnell said that's a non-starter, was his direct quote. Another suggestion for how to fund it would be to increase the gas tax. Senator John Thune said that even a 35 cent increase to the gas tax would only raise $500 billion.
And that would be not good news for Pennsylvania, already has the highest tax, right?
Pennsylvania carries the highest gas tax in the nation. What Chairman DeFazio said, who again chairs the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, what he said is, what I want to do is bond the money. So take out a bond, and then we would increase the gas tax by 1.5 cents per gallon per year, and that would guarantee a repayment stream for that bond.
And would that bond be enough for this?
It would allow them to borrow, he said, $500 billion. So that's not nothing. It's not $2 trillion. But he said ultimately the Ways and Means Committee and the president will have to work out how to pay for it.
We have about a minute left, a little less. And that is a $2 trillion if they agree on how to fund it, do they have any idea what criteria they will use to actually allocate funding?
All of this remains a hope. So Infrastructure Week in 2017 and 2018 has become a little bit of a joke. The administration pushed hard for it, but then it always ends up being overshadowed. This is the first time that people believe something could come out of this grand idea. As we talked about, there's no sense yet how it would be funded. The administration and congressional leaders are meeting in 2 weeks from today to discuss further how it would happen. But exactly what would be funded and what would be the criteria is way down the road.
And so that glimmer of hope is just because they're actually meeting.
They're actually meeting, and it's coming up on elections. People want to celebrate a win, a big legislative win, and infrastructure is badly needed across the United States.
Margaret J. Krause is WESA's transportation and infrastructure reporter. Thanks so much, Margaret.
Thanks, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Leopards are graceful big cats in the genus Panthera, and they live in a wide range of environments, from Africa to Central Asia and India and even China. But many of their populations are endangered or vulnerable, especially outside of the African continent. Charlotte Hacker is a PhD student at Duquesne University, and she has been awarded a prestigious Fulbright scholarship to study an at-risk population of snow leopards in their natural habitat. Charlotte, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So, Charlotte, how did you get interested in studying animals and specifically snow leopards?
Oh, it's a bit of a roundabout story, but I've always been really interested in wildlife and wildlife conservation. It's been something since I was little that I just really enjoyed animals. I didn't have many science influencers in my life aside from maybe Steve Irwin on TV or something like
right.
that. But then in college, I had some professors that really kind of inspired me and made me think outside the box. And I decided to study abroad in South Africa, loved it, ended up staying for a longer period of time, and actually met some wildlife conservationists working out in the field. And it really just kind of stuck with me, and I decided that was what I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
Did you always think you might work with vulnerable populations?
I think if you had told younger me that I would be doing what I'm doing now, I would be blown away. I don't think I always was interested in species that were more at risk. I think that I was more interested in problem solving. I've always been drawn to that kind of thing, which is why I love science so much. But as far as kind of working with these large, charismatic megafauna, that wasn't something that I always, you know, had the confidence to go out and do and pursue. And now it's just, you know, something that I'm so wildly passionate about.
Megafauna. Big
mammals. Yeah, big mammals. Yeah, big mammals.
Your upcoming trip, you're headed to China. What part?
So I will be, my lab and my institute that I work with is based out of Beijing, but my field sites are in Qinghai Province, China.
Give us a nice sense of what Qinghai Province is like. Give us a picture.
So it's right on the edge of the Tibetan Plateau, but it has a lot of mountains. It's this huge source region. There's lots of biodiversity. It's predominantly inhabited by Tibetans. So there's the Tibetan culture is very present there. And it's really kind of this hot spot for a lot of very unique flora and fauna, so different plants and animals that aren't found anywhere else in the world. Mm-hmm. And it can get pretty cold, obviously, but it can also kind of get warmer in the summer months as well.
So is that area well suited to the snow leopard?
It is. In fact, some areas of Qinghai Province are kind of what I like to call snow leopard paradise. So these very kind of long stretches of continuous mountainous habitats that are really idyllic for snow leopards and their ecology.
For our listeners who aren't as familiar, what do they look like? I mean, how do they compare with what we might picture as a leopard, you know, that spotted orange cousin we often see in photos?
Yeah. Snow leopards are similar, but they're so well adapted to these very snow, high altitude environments and on the mountains particularly. You'll notice that they have these really long, bushy tails, and that serves as kind of a rudder to help them steer and navigate through the mountains while they're chasing down prey.
And coloration?
Coloration, they're very well blended with their habitats, and so they're going to look very similar to these mountainous landscapes. Most of the time they have kind of gray, white coloring, and then there's those characteristics, kind of the dark spotted rosettes.
Right. It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Charlotte Hacker, PhD student at Duquesne University. She's been awarded a Fulbright scholarship to study an at-risk population of snow leopards in their natural habitat in China. So you plan to study their eating habits. Do they have enough food where they are in China's Qinghai province, or are they expanding their food source?
So those are questions that we want to answer. Specifically, snow leopards have always had kind of this fluctuating prey base. So typically, snow leopards are going to prefer large hoof stock, so things like blue sheep and argali, which is a wild sheep species, Siberian ibex, markhoor. But those are species that have some of them been poached to themselves, and so there's a depleted prey base from that. There's also overgrazing from livestock. So most herders in that area have many numerous livestock, and then the livestock eat the grass, and then the wild species don't have any grass to eat, and then they die off, and snow leopards are left without a wild prey base. And this is problematic because there's livestock present. So snow leopards do have a food source, but then that causes conflict with herders.
And the herders get upset. Are they retaliating?
Yeah, so in some places they are. This is an issue that kind of varies throughout snow leopard range. But essentially, snow leopards aren't like other big cats. I think we often think of big cats as being ferocious and dangerous. And there's never been a documented case of a snow leopard killing a human in the wild. And so unfortunately, they can be pretty easily baited by a herder, by just leaving a carcass out of like a goat or another animal. And then that herder can easily eliminate that snow leopard and eliminate the threat of them taking their livestock again.
That retaliation, is that a reason why they're vulnerable?
It is one of the reasons. There are many factors influencing a population decline in snow leopards, but that is one of them, yes.
All right. So specifically, your work, we talked about studying the eating habits. How are you going to study the eating habits?
So we use a non-invasive approach where we go into snow leopard habitat and search on the ground for what snow leopards leave behind. And in our case, that's feces. We call it scat.
Right.
And what we do is we extract the DNA sequence of what's in that scat sample and therefore figure out what the snow leopard ate.
So is the ultimate goal conservation, especially for people native to Qinghai province?
Yeah. I mean, it's finding solutions to help conserve snow leopards, but then also really involving the local community and really providing a platform for which, you know, local stakeholders can be involved and have their voices heard, and to provide them with information that helps them formulate solutions to protect their livestock and their livelihoods.
Culture comes into play. Does religion come into play? I understand predominant religion in this area is Tibetan Buddhism, which reveres the animal. So how do you mix, you know, the reverence for an animal with maybe the herders who are retaliating because their herds are being wiped out or decimated?
Yeah, I'm sure it's, you know, it's, we did a study interviewing local herders to try to understand that dynamic a little bit better. And most herders had positive attitudes towards snow leopards. They were just not, you know, when it comes to their actually protecting their livestock, there does become come a tipping point. I think snow leopards are less at risk than other species such as wolves, which aren't as popular, and not something that's viewed positively in Tibetan folklore and culture. But religion definitely plays a role in intolerance towards snow leopards and ultimately in their conservation.
This is your fourth trip to China.
Yes, it is.
Does having that prestigious honor, such as the Fulbright, behind your name now add a little gravitas to the project?
You know, it's so surreal. I'm just really excited about it. I think that it really gives us the opportunity to answer some really interesting and awesome questions. And I have such an amazing support system, both here and China, that I'm really excited. And I think the project is definitely going to be successful.
So I have to ask you, what are you looking forward to the most?
So it's funny, the first year I went to China, I had a really hard time with the food. But now it's something that I really miss when I'm back here. There's so much awesome culture and history there. And so I think just having new experiences and being able to do what I love and work towards conserving, you know, an at-risk species is just altogether a great package that makes it a really great experience.
Are you confident that your work and the work of others who are studying endangered and vulnerable species can make a difference? Are we ready to make a difference?
Definitely. I think sitting on our hands isn't going to do us any good. And like you mentioned, other organizations and other people that are doing kind of similar work, I think. And in particular with the snow leopard, it's been amazing to see how many different organizations and people have come together to help protect the species. And there's definitely some camaraderie in that, for sure.
Charlotte Hacker is a PhD student at Duquesne University. She has been awarded a prestigious Fulbright scholarship to study an at-risk population of snow leopards in their natural habitat in China. Charlotte, thanks so much for making the time for us ahead of your travels, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania has not executed a death row inmate in 20 years, and only three since capital punishment was reinstated in 1976. Two members of the State House want Pennsylvania to join the growing list of states banning the death penalty. Joining us now is University of Pittsburgh law professor and WESA's legal analyst, David Harris. Hello, David.
Good to be with you, Kevin.
So, proposals in the legislature to eliminate capital punishment in Pennsylvania, they're not unusual, are they? It's been happening for a while.
It's happened before, and it'll happen again probably if this one does not succeed. So this is something that's come up. What's unusual now is the bipartisan nature of this particular proposal. You've got it coming from both parties, both sides of the aisle, and that's new.
And it officially has not been introduced yet because the two sponsors that you alluded to, one Republican, one Democrat, they're still passing along, which is standard practice, passing along their proposal to get co-sponsors to sign on. And we'll see then just how bipartisan it is.
Absolutely. But the fact that it's bipartisan at all, even a little bit, is a huge change from a decade, two decades ago, when the death penalty was kind of a litmus test for the conservative side, the lock 'em up sort of jurisprudence that actually we saw across the board. Things used to be completely the other direction. You couldn't be for the repeal of the death penalty and have a chance of being electable in a state like Pennsylvania.
David, there's bipartisan, and then there's bipartisan. You can have a Democrat and a Republican who are not maybe necessarily all that separated by political views. But here we have a very progressive Democrat in Chris Rabb and a conservative Republican in Frank Ryan partnering to ban the death penalty. It's really a de facto ban, though, isn't it, right now, because of the moratorium that Governor Wolf said he was putting in place 4 years ago.
Right. There is a moratorium that's effective now, and there hasn't been an execution in Pennsylvania in quite a number of years. So by way of just the facts on the ground, we don't really have an operating death penalty now. What this proposal is trying to do is to move from the de facto ground into the law itself, to change the law. And these two people who are the primary movers are coming at it from very different points of view. As you say, one is very progressive, one is very conservative. And so they have different reasons for wanting to abolish the death penalty. But this is really emblematic of a lot of the reform impulse that we're starting to see in the last 5 years across the board in the United States, as we've looked at mass incarceration, and we see what an incredible failure it's been, a debacle, a huge financial sinkhole for the country and every state. You have these impulses coming from different reasons, but from different areas of the political spectrum, but all converging on the same point. We've been doing the wrong things to control crime and to do our criminal justice work in a smart way. And so you see it from completely different angles converging at the same point.
Cost factor, you mentioned cost factor of incarceration.
Yes.
Cost factor is often brought up as a reason to get rid of the death penalty. As one such instance.
Absolutely, because the death penalty, when it comes to litigating in the courts, requires extra layers of appeals and process. And that's appropriate, frankly, when the state is going to take somebody's life. Even if you agree with the death penalty, I mean, obviously you must get this right because there's no turning back. If you execute an innocent person, that's really the worst thing that could possibly happen. So a whole extra layer of appeals, protections, legal representation is what you have to have if you're going to have capital punishment. Whereas if you have even life without parole, it's always possible to reverse a mistake.
So, and other reasons, it's not a deterrent cited by people against the death penalty.
That's correct.
And it's just implemented unfairly.
Yes, there's no proof ever that's been advanced that is well done anyway, that is not flawed, that shows that this is a deterrent to crime. And that makes intuitive sense if you think that most people who engage in a murder, a homicide, this is an impulsive behavior, not a planned behavior. And there's nothing that tells us that life without parole isn't an adequate punishment. And so there's no pragmatic justification for it in that sense.
All right. We have a minute left. Has this been a slowly developing trend, or has there been sort of an abrupt, okay, states are now getting rid of it?
Well, we had a very interesting guest on Criminal Injustice to my podcast who's written a book called At the End of Its Rope. His name is Brandon Garrett, and he showed how the death penalty has actually been falling away from a high in 1999 almost 100 executions in a year to something like 20, 22, 25 a year now. So it's on a long-term decline, and there's no showing or no sense that it's going to change.
In our last 30 seconds, historically, Republicans have been particularly cautious about rolling back the death penalty. They still control both the House and Senate in Pennsylvania. Do you think this bill might have a different outcome this time around?
It's possible. It's going to be a hard slog for the reasons that you mentioned. Any reform bills going through our Republican two-house legislature are always hard, but here you have sponsorship from both sides.
David Harris is WESA's legal analyst, a University of Pittsburgh law professor, and host of the Criminal Injustice Podcast. David, thanks so much.
A pleasure, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, a conversation with the incoming president of Allegheny College, Hillary Link, about how her work on an Italian campus will help her with her new job. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Joe Yazenkovich and Meg Fair. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.